America's Southern Liberal Talk Host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Surprise, Sergeant Carter, it's Friday on the front porch.
And I'm Bob Kincaid, and yes, this is live, this is for real, no kidding. I was able to get back here to the studio after the close of today's PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, PRISM West Virginia session, a series of excellent discussions. First of all, by Tom Tierney, Dr. Tom Tierney, of the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. And we closed the day with a discussion of the relationship between land-grabbing white folks and the native peoples who lived here, led by Professor Keith Lilly. But we broke fairly early in the afternoon. And that allowed Ferg and I to get, that's Horn intern junior grade Ferg, otherwise known as Eager Young Jedi Ferg, that name given him by Albert in Wisconsin, Eager Young Jedi Ferg. That enabled us to jump in the rusty red pickup truck and beat a hasty advance. Or, that's right, home and the studio. So, yes, indeed, we do have a Friday on the Front Porch edition of the program. Now, next week, no show on the 4th of July, because we'll be on the road going back to Athens, West Virginia. No show on the 4th of July. And then the rest of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, is all PRISM West Virginia. And I don't know if you tuned in thus far, but if you have not, you have been missing, how can I describe it, a mind-expanding exploration of the philosophies, the theories, the intellectual world that led to the founding of the United States. So appropriate insofar as July the 4th is, in fact, Independence Day. We have heard from an education leader, a man who developed the data-based questions approach to the teaching of history, Phil Roden. We have heard from Dr. Bob Bliss. He presently heads the Honors College at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He came all the way to West Virginia to share his expertise relating to the founding. We heard from Dr. Tom Tierney, whose examination of Hobbes, Locke, Hume, was nothing short of, it was bracing. That's what it was. It was intellectually bracing. And closed out today, as I said, with Professor Keith Lilly and an examination of the First Peoples as they responded to the westward bent of the colonial Americans. It's all right there for you on Ustream.tv. If you go to Ustream.tv and simply search American History Seminar, it'll pop right up, and you can go and watch any or all of it. And I encourage you to do so. because it's amazing. Also along the way, if you have been watching or if you do watch these archives, you might notice something. You might notice something about how the video itself is presented. I'm not going to go into any specifics, but you might notice some differences. You might notice something about the audio and the video, that it's not what one usually gets in a Ustream broadcast. And in so noting, you might consider that perhaps there might be something on the way as time passes in the way of changes to how the horn sounds and, in fact, what the horn looks like. Not going to say any more beyond that. I will say this much, however, and I'm moved to say it by the fact that it is and has been one of those stunningly beautiful days where I don't know about you, but I just about had to be chased back inside with a cattle prod. Gorgeous. High blue sky. Moderate, decent temperatures. A little breeze. No rain. All of that leads me to suggest that, in fact, somewhere later this summer, and it'll be after July the 15th, because that's how long PRISM West Virginia continues. All of next week and 4 days of the following. But I am moved to suggest that it is entirely possible that, lo and behold, for all the times that I have said, you know what would be nice? It would be nice to not be doing this show inside this studio right now. There is a distinct possibility. There is a distinct possibility that, well, we'd have to do a little serious remedial work on the porch because it's got things like a lawnmower on it right now, and there's not a lot of rocking chairs or anything. But we, by God, at some point in time, might actually have, in the fairly near future, a Friday in the front yard. And wouldn't that be cool? Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. Kudos have to go out to John Fox, the chief engineer of the horn, and webmaster, web designer, and longtime technical guru, who worked long and hard to make things sound quite amazingly good during this PRISM broadcast. And those things will be brought online with the horn, those changes in sound. And I can't say enough about what John has done. It is nothing short of stupendous. Good evening to the chat room. I'm tickled to see that there's a couple of folks in the chat room, because frankly I didn't announce the Friday on the Front Porch edition, this Friday on the Front Porch edition, until just a couple of minutes before broadcast time. Word is getting out, however. I've noticed a couple of retweets from Matt Osborne and our buddy Jack in Shreveport. So there may be more. But as it stands, good evening to Mr. Gibson and Zatoichi. Good to see the both of you. Hope you have a fun and enjoyable next couple of hours or so. You, of course, can join in the fun and the fun and frolics over at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room if you so desire. Just go to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, and after you've made a quick run by the tab called Contribute and hit the PayPal button, because wow, did we take a whacking in June, and we need all the help we can get in July. We're always looking for 250 people. 250 people who will kick in the relatively minuscule sum of $10 apiece, thereby just taking care of fundraising like that for any given month. After you've run by the contribute tab, just go to the chat room tab and come on in and hang out and have a good time. The conversation is well past wonderful. You are more than welcome to do that, and again, it's free. Because, you know, things like contributing to Keep the Horn on the Air, there is no linkage between your ability, between doing that and then your ability to join the chat room or have these podcasts at any time of your choosing or tune in to the rerun stream or listen live for that matter. This is not some sort of commercialized, profitized, corporatized, monetized effort. This is about keeping the conversation going and not working on saving up for the Gulfstream 5. Okay? So that's where that stands. But it is the weekend of Independence Day. And I am energized by what I have been hearing over the last several days, Wednesday, yesterday, today, the PRISM series is designed to help teachers of history better convey historical information to their students. But it also has applications far beyond that, as those of you who have watched and or listened know. It is something extremely special. Just because the depth of information presented is unlike anything you will get just about anywhere else. You know, last night I tweeted that Dr. Tom Tierney's discussion resembled a TED Talk as much as anything else. It just reminded me of the kind of dynamism that attends those TED Talks that you can watch over at TED.com or whatever the website name is. For the way it gets your head going. So I'm certainly energized by that. And if you go back and watch, you will be as well. So with all that as prelude, I certainly hope you will be having a wonderful Independence Day holiday weekend. We won't be going anywhere for the 4th. And what we do in the way of celebrating it will happen on Sunday because of the fact that Ferg and I will be back in the Rusty Red pickup truck come Sunday evening, driving back down to the beautiful, bucolic campus of Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. But I hope you all have, you know, I think Saturday it'll probably happen. Saturday we'll get maybe a pork shoulder on the smoker and just pour the smoke to that bad boy for 12, 16 hours or so until it just flakes apart. Make some awe-inspiring, zesty, spicy barbecue sauce and, I don't know, just have barbecued pork pig sandwiches for our celebration of Independence Day. Whatever you do, chime right in. If you have special plans for Independence Day, share that as you call in this evening. And let's just see what Independence Day among the Horn family feels like. Of course, a lot of us will simply be celebrating it by working. Others of us will celebrate it quietly in our homes. But I have no doubt that we will all observe it in our own way. On Monday, the 4th, before we do jump in the rusty red truck and head back to Athens, West Virginia, I will do what has become a little bit of a quirky habit of my own. I'll stand in the front yard and read the Declaration of Independence aloud. Because, although a written document, certainly, it was designed to be read out loud. It was designed as a piece of beautiful. Oh, wouldn't the right wingers just hate to hear this? a beautiful piece of propaganda to motivate people who might not have otherwise come to a decision as to which side of the dispute they were on. Because while the right wing and the teabaggers, who make up their own history as they go along and have a constitution that exists only in their own imaginations, kind of like Herman Cain, where actual parts of the Declaration of Independence are actually contained inside the Constitution. No, really. Everybody wasn't on board as of July the 4th, 1776. Some were, some weren't. Some, whether or not they were or weren't, were not invited to have an opinion. You might recall that women didn't have a vote, and people who labored but did not own property were not thought very highly of in that day and age. But they could certainly be handy, the laboring men, they could be handy when it came to needing some people holding muskets to point at the guys in the bright red suits. That particular period of history is nothing if not equivocal. Not everybody wanted to be free of Britain. The Native Americans, who had been pushed and pushed and pushed across the Allegheny frontier and by that point across the Ohio River, who, as Keith Lilly noted so brilliantly earlier today, the Shawnee, what was known as the Battle of Two Indy Way, otherwise known as Point Pleasant, West Virginia, you realize that the first battle of the Revolution didn't happen in Massachusetts. It happened on the banks of the confluence of the Ohio and the Kanawha River, the Great Kanawha, in what was then Virginia and is now West Virginia. When the Shawnee people, put out by the fact that the British insisted on continuing to push the frontiers westward, claimed the right to do so by virtue of having purchased those lands from members of the Iroquois Confederacy, to which, as Keith Lilly noted, the Shawnee responded by saying, "Of course they sold you that land. It wasn't theirs to sell. Nobody can own land. They think you're idiots." And even if they did believe that a human being could own land or air or water, they still conned you because it was our land, not theirs. Because members of the Iroquois Confederacy had said to the British, "Oh yeah, you want to buy that? We'll sell it to you." "Yeah, because see, we went down and we conquered it, you know? And, like, we took all, we cleaned everybody out. There's nobody there. We just wiped everybody out. It's ours, you know. I mean, did you see we put the for sale sign in the yard?" "Yeah, we've got title." Only they didn't. And this mightily pissed off people Cornstalk of the Shawnee people. And so it came to blows along the confluence of the Kanawha and the Great Ohio River in 1775. Maybe 1774. Goodness me. Shame on me for not knowing right. Well, it's been a long week. But it was the first battle of the American Revolution. The first land battle, of course, of the Civil War was also fought in what is now West Virginia, at a little place called Philippi. Things that happened here and why they happened. There's a reason for knowing the history of this region. A little pitch here. If you have never purchased, then I highly encourage you to do so. If you've never purchased Jeff Bigger's The United States of Appalachia, there's no such thing as a bad time to purchase it. It is a fascinating book, and it covers things like this. But at any rate, That's where it started. Lord, wouldn't you love to hear? Wouldn't you love to hear? Godzilla from Wasilla. Or Michelle, batshit crazy Bachman, trying to even pronounce, let alone explain, the dynamics behind the Battle of Tuendi Way. The laughter might very well not subside for decades. Be sort of like a ripple in a pond. But there is a ton of stuff to talk about this evening. Some more serious than others. Some downright frightening, others frustrating. I personally am fearful for the well-being of the people on the Gaza flotilla ship Audacity of Hope, and can only hope that they will not be gunned down in cold blood by the Israelis. But let's get this, before we get into that sort of stuff, let's have a giggle. And I refer you to something from the Jimmy Kimmel Show. You may have seen it already. You may not have. But either way you slice it, damn, it's funny. It's funny even without the visuals. This is, this is from the Jimmy Kimmel Show, Michelle Bachman's Story of America. Warning! I'm gonna give you a five count. I'm gonna give you a little NASA countdown, so that whatever's in your mouth, you can go ahead, you know, chew it, swallow it, spit it out, whatever you need to do, because you know what, your computer monitor just doesn't need that kind of mistreatment. Because this is spit take inducing stuff. Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
In 1775, Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams set sail across the Delaware River to tell the King of England that they had had enough of his liberal agenda. King James called Napoleon and together decided to kill America. They sent the Nina, the Pinata, and the Santa Maria to fight. But then, George Washington and Abraham Lincoln gathered an army to turn back the big government dictators. They told Paul Revere to ride his horse to Frodo, to tell him to cast the ring of power into the fires of Mount Doom. But then, John Wilkes Booth showed up and killed Lincoln. But there was still hope, because Jesus appeared on the face of the Liberty Bell, and he froze John Wilkes Booth in carbonite. And the liberal homosexuals sailed back to their gay country, while Americans claimed their land and drank beer. And that's how freedom was born.
Oh, there are just brilliant little touches inside that. Did you notice? That's how freedom was born. B-O-R-N-E-D. You know, it's only marginally funny because, well, no, it's really funny. But it's frightening because it's not that far. It's not that far from the truth, from the way this god-awful woman, and I can't use the word thinks, but processes and propounds sick and twisted information. So, yeah, a little giggle. Yeah, that Mr. Gibson, me too. Told Paul Revere to ride to Frodo and... Oh, because it's all invented fantasy in their world, and they believe in things like virgins having babies and other insane and zombies rising from the dead. Yeah, well, what are you going to do? They're right-wingers. And again, I encourage you to go back and either listen to, because it should be going up on White Rose Society, listen to Tom Tierney's discussions. There are three of them. Or watch them on YouTube. Or not YouTube, on Ustream, ustream.tv. Because he does such a brilliant job explaining something that would probably make Michelle Bachmann choke, that would cause Mussolini, you know, Caribou Barbie, to start speaking in tongues and writhing on the floor. And that is this. And Newt Gingrich, Newt would probably fall down and break something that he bought at Tiffany's. So, that thing is that they're all, it's even hard for me to say, they're all liberals. They are all, each and every one of them, liberals. And I really think that it's important to our national discourse. I wish that this kind of discussion could get wider dissemination, because I think it would take a lot of the starch out of the K Street assholes who are determined to keep working people in this country split asunder from one another. They're all liberals. Because whether you are Barack Obama, me, Newt Gingrich, or anyone anywhere in between, we'll put Newt over Newt and Caribou Barbie and batshit crazy Bachman and Good Hair Perry. We'll put them over on the right side, and we'll put me over on what amounts to the left side. We'll put Barack Obama somewhere in the middle and verging toward the right. You know, me and Dennis Kucinich, people like that, we're over here. You, us. But the whole thing springs out of the liberal tradition that was spawned by the likes of Thomas Hobbes, David Hume, and John Locke. Lucky for you, all of whose writings are available for free because the copyright wore off a long time ago. I'll tell you a little secret. Not a secret, it's just nothing that's particularly known, and there's not a monument up or anything, but it is my understanding that one of the first people ever to publish some of the works of David Hume, Scotsman that he was my multi-great-grandfather, a man by the name of Alexander Kincaid, a publisher in Edinburgh. Bruh. See, you got to do that with the R. Bruh. Just like that little mini-chorus inside Uncle Albert Admiral Halsey. Bruh, bruh. Yeah, Edinburgh. Yeah. And it's, you know, and that's kind of fun to think about. But everything, all of American political discourse springs, insofar as it springs from discussions about how to have and run a country, that was followed up with things like the Federalist Papers, the Constitution itself, the Declaration of Independence, Rousseau, Hobbes, Hume, Locke. We're all their children, because nobody's out there arguing that, well, as Tom Tierney noted, there are some, there just aren't really enough of them to be truly entertaining, but they do seem to be gathering a little bit of steam. The Burkean paleoconservatives, they're out there, and they're a real Lulu when you get around them. You can see some of it in the insanity that froths, flows, ejaculates, and otherwise burbles forth from people like Slappy Thomas and Fat Tony Scalia. But we are. Every last one of us. We are children of Locke. We are children of Hobbes. We are children of Hume. Children of Rousseau. And that's worth thinking about once in a while. Because the Declaration of Independence, whose publication we celebrate on Monday, was not handed down on some mountain by some invisible cloud critter imaginary friend. It was crafted primarily by three men working together, namely, to wit, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. No, Michelle Bachman, John Quincy Adams wasn't there. God, I can only assume that in the previous few days, I can only assume that you have caught up with the controversy around the fact that she refused to walk back from her statement that the founders worked tirelessly to end slavery and conferred founder status on John Quincy Adams. Not his daddy John, but John Quincy.
Well, he was a little boy, but he acted as secretary to his pa.
Jeebus. So, the only thing that a person has to have in the way of founder status is to have been alive at the time the revolution, or some portion of it, was fought. No kidding. That's like saying, what? That Alexander Graham Bell's... Did he have children? I don't know. But if he did, that his kids were also inventors of the telephone because they were alive at the time that Bell, having spilled some acid on his hand, said, "Watson, come here, I need you." Yeah, that makes the children who were alive back then inventors of the telephone. Silly, ain't it? Yes, it is. But that's kind of where my head is this evening. And just in case you're not quite as strange as I and aren't prone to stand in your front yard reading the Declaration to passing critters and cars kicking up dust on the little road going by, just in case, let's look at these words real quick. This brilliant document designed to move the hearts and minds of American colonials toward the side of independence, in which, as it would turn out, a different class of rich people would wind up running their lives as opposed to titled rich people in England. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And there begins the he has list of grievances which the authors of the Declaration of Independence felt that they had against the King of England. Things such as, he has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless these people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He's called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness. Now, you gotta wonder, is manly firmness, Franklin, though a serious and very wealthy man, was also a bit of a jokester. Is that Franklin at work there? Manly firmness. Just putting a little chuckle inside the declaration here. Or maybe a little, He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. So you see, the representative houses have manly firmness. But, of course, the impression created is that the King of England, George III, is a mincing panty waist who has no manly firmness. It's propaganda. Really. Understand it as such. And to refer to it as propaganda, contrary to the right-wingers, the way they knee-jerk respond to any textual criticism, it's propaganda. The fact that it's propaganda doesn't mean it's bad. It means that it is in the form of it's an apologetic, and it is argumentative. But being good propaganda, it presents only one side of the argument. There's no part of the Declaration of Independence where the King of England gets to go, hey, wait, no, it's not like that at all. He has refused for a long time. Well, a long time. How long is that, Tom, Ben, John? Oh, long time. Long time, Bob. Long time. He has refused. Days, months, weeks, years? Who knows? He's refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise. The state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. The state. Convulsions within. How about that? Sounds like maybe folks were a little restless in the colonies, and nobody really had a way of putting it down. That maybe we might want to be suppressing some thoughts among some people, that maybe there might be some dissent and discourse out there that needed quashing. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migration hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. Oh, that's a... You know, that paragraph is just a Jim Dandy. Wonder how that would go over if you read it to, say, oh, I don't know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Or if you read it to, say, Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama. Do you know about Mo Brooks of Alabama? This is a dandy. Mo Brooks, a pig licking from Alabama, attended a town hall recently. WHNT News is a station in Huntsville, Alabama. And speaking to them, he said the following. I'm not going to bother you with the audio. I wanted to and he was talking about immigration. Now let's get this all nice and squared up so it'll fit together nicely. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states. In other words, they're saying that George III wasn't letting in enough immigrants willy-nilly. For that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners. Foreigners? Not just good Englishmen? Maybe some Germans or Dutch? Who knows? Some Spaniards? Portuguese? French? We like the French. You can imagine George III thinking, man, by Jove, that's probably... No, actually, he thought in German, but anyway. They were mad at George III because he wouldn't just let anybody who wanted to come to the Americas. Yeah, that's what he needed. A whole bunch more French people in his colonies. Yeah, because the French and the British got along so well. 100 Years' War, 5 Years' War, wars of this, wars of that. Napoleonic Wars were yet to come. Tensions were not unknown. But this is the authors of the Declaration of Independence claiming that there's not enough immigration. And raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. Appropriations of lands. He's not letting us steal as much land as we want from the natives who have lived here for the last 20,000 years. There are moments in the Declaration of Independence where the bigotries and biases of the authors and signatories just come racing to the forefront, and that's one of them. And raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands, because the British Crown kept saying, no, okay, you colonists, stop there. Okay, you didn't stop. Stop here. Oh, damn, you went... Okay, stop at the Ohio River, and by Jove, I really mean it. Stop at the Ohio River. And they kept going. I mean, remember, by the time of the Jefferson administration in the early 1800s, migration had taken place all the way out into Missouri, and there was argument that the colonization effort led by his vice president, Aaron Burr, which was miscast by a very piqued and peeved Thomas Jefferson, as an insurrection. Suddenly that right of the people to form a new government wasn't... That just didn't have the same old ring it had in 1776 when somebody wanted to do it to Tom. Just because they were brilliant didn't mean they didn't have those little hypocritical moments. And remember, we're talking about people who were drinking a gallon and a half of wine per person per day. And that's the wine. We're not... Then there's the beer. And after the beer, they're into the cider. One of the little-known facts of history that is taught out there is that a whole bunch of the people who brought about American independence were dead, stone, drunk, 24/7. And that's without mentioning Dr. Happy's bottle of laudanum. Because everybody with means had a bottle of Dr. Happy's bottle of laudanum. Yeah, a little alcohol. Yeah, because the stuff was, Jesus, 140 proof with opium. Now with opium, new and improved. And addictive. Those are the people who put together the revolution. They knew how to have a good time. Or they knew how to at least alleviate what were some pretty tough, pretty ugly times. I mean, come on, no paved roads. Everything was slop. When it was dry, the dust was choking, and when it was wet, everything was muck. But anyway, back to our buddy Mo Brooks. So talking to WHNT-TV News out of Huntsville, Alabama. That's how you guys say Huntsville. Huntsville. Dialect in Alabama, they don't have quite enough energy by the time they get to the end of a word to actually finish it. So what should be Huntsville, or is Huntsville in Texas, for instance? That's Huntsville. Huntsville. They just sort of run out of effort. Huntsville. Albertville. Russellville. Just run out of Huntsville. So he's talking to WHNT-TV News in Huntsville with regard to immigration. Remember the immigration that Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and John Adams and everybody who signed the Declaration of Independence wanted a lot more of? Yeah, Mo Brooks hasn't read the Declaration of Independence ever, probably. And if he has, it was a long time ago for the you know, fifth grade teacher who threatened to spank him if he didn't. So in speaking to WHNT-TV News, Mo Brooks of Alabama, and I would assume that's Alabama's 5th Congressional District, so this is the idiot who represents the poor, decent people of that little corner of the state from whence I came. Mo Brooks said, I wanted to ensure people that I have an intensity on this subject that will have to address the illegal alien issue. They have no right to be here. They are clogging up our emergency rooms and making our education system more expensive. If you go to the Madison County Jail, there are far too many illegal aliens there because they have victimized Americans. WHNT writes, Brooks's intensity is clear. He did not flinch when asked to repeat what he said during a recent town hall meeting. As your congressman on the House floor, I will do anything short of shooting them. Anything that is lawful, it needs to be done because illegal aliens need to quit taking jobs from American citizens. Where are my pillowcase? No, really. All dialect aside, he said that. As your congressman on the House floor, I will do anything short of shooting them. Back to the Declaration of Independence. Raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands, we discussed that. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing to his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. That's Tom, John, and Ben saying, you know, we want to set up our own court system separate and apart from his, and he doesn't like that. Like I said, there's no but wait part, you know, of the Declaration of Independence. He's made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount of payment of their salaries. When we want to be the ones who set their tenure of offices, and we want to set the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. When we've got our own friends that we want to have eat out their substance. He's kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature. Well, okay, but what's unsaid here is without the consent of our legislature, which would be hell froze over coming. He is affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power. Paren, when we would far prefer to do that ourselves. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution. Constitution which didn't exist. And unacknowledged by our laws. Giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. Even though the pretended legislation was passed by the legislature, which was not pretending and really was the British Parliament. Okay, so that's the he has portion. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, not mentioning the fact that the large numbers of armed troops were occasioned by the cantankerous rebelliousness of the colonials. For protecting them by mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. And I gotta think John Adams had a real problem with that clause. Because what they were doing, they were pointing up at the Boston Massacre, in which John Adams himself, lawyer, had defended the British soldiers who were accused of murder and gotten them acquitted for protecting them by mock trial. Is that Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin just sort of poking John Adams in the eye? Because when John Adams was defending the guys from the Boston Massacre, he didn't think there was anything mock about it, nor did they. For we're cutting off our trade with all parts of the world. Hey, he's interfering with our right to make money. They just kind of buried that down deep in the Declaration of Independence when, in fact, that's what had a lot of the, I mean, to the extent that there were people on board with this, that's what had a lot of the colonials just flat out pissed off. Hey, he's cutting into the profits for imposing taxes on us without our consent. Dear colonies, I have just spent a horse-gagging load of money. Now, let's do this right.
Dear colonies, I've just spent a horse-gagging load of money in order to protect your sorry colonial hides during the recent unpleasantries known commonly as the French and Indian War. It was not cheap. Would you mind, pretty please, to contribute a pittance to your own defense and actually pay some portion of the money that I have expended in making sure that the heathen savages didn't descend upon your little villages and set fire to your, I don't know, exchequer, does mud burn? Set fire to your thatched roofs.
Because that's what that was all about. The British Crown actually wanted the colonies to help pay for the defense that they received and were really happy to have during the French and Indian War. And that's where that taxation without representation business came from. You're going to raise a little revenue. You people are getting expensive. So you get the idea. For depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury. Okay. Was that in cases where trial by jury was mandated by Anglo jurisprudence, by the common law? I love this one. For transporting us beyond the seas to be tried for pretended offenses. Beyond seas being what, back to Great Britain? Because I don't think they were transporting people from the American colonies to Australia to put them on trial. In other words, that's the signatories to the Declaration saying, wait a minute, we're sitting here fomenting rebellion and committing treason, and the king has the unmitigated gall to want to put us on a boat and bring us back to London and try us. And maybe put our heads above a gate somewhere on a spike. We don't like that! Oh, it goes on and on. But like I said, the bigotries do sneak out here and there. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers to whom they give a name, the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In other words, he's trying to get the Indians mad at us because we keep breaching the legal boundaries established by the Crown, and the Indians get mad, and they come in, and they do to us what we do to them. They kill everything that lives, walks, crawls, breathes, swims, whatever. And it's the king's fault. It's not our fault! This is the kid with his hand in the last broken shard of the neck of the cookie jar with cookie dust and broken jar all over the floor going, "Will you put the jar here, Mom?" The colonials wouldn't stop moving westward. Full disclosure, my forebears, part of the problem. Really? Yeah, part of the problem. Should have stopped over in Augusta County, Virginia before the Allegheny Front begins. Didn't. Kept coming. Such that my ancient forebear, Long Billy McClung, was the first white settler on the Meadow River not far from here. His grave is still there, can be found, whatever. That guy I've told you about who did all his plowing with the reins in his teeth, one hand on the plow and another one holding a musket shooting gun. There's a reason he needed the musket. There's a reason his wife was sitting on the cabin porch with another musket. They were thieves. They had illegally moved into this area beyond the area of consent by the Crown and started homesteading on land that did not belong to them, but which had been ostensibly, maybe, sort of, kind of, sold to the colony of Virginia by an Indian tribe who'd never even freaking lived here. To which the Shawnees said, excuse me? I'm not going to blush from my own history, from my own past. Why would we hide from reality? It's a fact. But, you know, we're talking about brilliant people here in the persons of Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams, and they were experts at making lemonade out of lemons. Because when it came to what my forebears and the forebears of many others were doing, well, wait a minute. Well, they're just hard-working yeoman farmers doing what hard-working yeoman farmers do. And it's the king's fault, right? Yeah, it's all the king's fault.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Precisely. It was the king's fault, damn it. It was the king's fault. The merciless Indian savages. As Keith Lilly noted earlier today, go read some of the speeches of these merciless Indian savages. See how merciless they seem to you. Because they don't sound merciless at all to me. They sound decidedly enlightened. When you read the speech of Cornstalk, the Shawnee chief, the last passage of that speech in which he renounces, or not renounces, that speech of Cornstalk in which he notes that his people are on the way out. That if you don't sit and nearly weep, there's something dead inside you. And there's Chief Logan, also dating back to that time of Lord Dunmore's War, the opening volley in the American Revolution. Now remember, and it's interesting because Thomas Jefferson would later remark in his notes on the history of Virginia that Logan was eloquent as any of the rhetoricians of the classical world. He put them up, you know, up there with, he put him up there with Cicero, for God's sakes. And yet, in the Declaration of Independence, he says, he has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Well, here are the words of a couple of those merciless Indian savages. I appeal to any white man to say if he ever entered Logan's cabin hungry, and he gave him not meat. If he ever came cold and naked, and he clothed him not. Now, this is a pagan. He is not washed in the blood of Christ or has salvation. And yet here is Chief Logan, who is echoing the very words of Jesus Christ. I appeal to any white man to say if he ever entered Logan's cabin hungry, and he gave him not meat. If he ever came cold and naked, and he clothed him not. During the course of the last long and bloody war, Logan remained idle in his cabin, an advocate for peace. Such was my love for the whites that my countrymen pointed as I passed and said, Logan is a friend of the white man. I've even thought to live with you, but for the injuries of one man, Colonel Cressap, who last spring, in cold blood and unprovoked, murdered the relatives of Logan, not even sparing his wife and children. Again, the Declaration of Independence. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Colonel Cressap, who last spring, in cold blood and unprovoked, murdered the relatives of Logan, not even sparing his wife and children. There runs not a drop of my blood in the veins of any living creature. This has called on me for revenge. I have sought it. I have killed many. I have fully glutted my vengeance. For my country, I rejoice in the beams of peace. But do not harbor a thought that mine is the joy of fear. Logan never felt fear. He will not turn on his heel to save his life. Who is there to mourn for Logan? Not one. And in 1777, somewhere near what is now Detroit, Logan was murdered. And even then, he was trying to oppose the American revolutionaries, who even then were actively engaged in the destruction of his entire world and all those who shared his way of life, and yet who had the nerve in the Declaration of Independence to discuss the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Cornstalk of the Shawnee saw what was coming, saw the end of his own race, or his own people, his own culture. Race is something that was invented by white people, mostly Brits. And Cornstalk said, I was the border man's friend. Many times I have saved him and his people from harm. I never warred with you, but only to protect our wigwams and lands. I refuse to join your pale-face enemies with the redcoats. I came to the fort as your friend, and you murdered me. You have murdered, by my side, my young son. For this may the curse of the Great Spirit rest upon this land. May it be blighted by nature. May it be even be blighted in its hopes. May the strength of its peoples be paralyzed by the stain of our blood. And long before I ever read that the first time, I wondered if perhaps in many ways, for all its accomplishments, this is a cursed country. You want to know why places like Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi are as cursed and benighted as they are? You need look no further than the torrents of blood let loose by white people on that land in the slaughters of the people who lived there. You want to know why Southerners are unquiet people and why they cannot seem to live in peace? It goes beyond some sort of issue of character or temperament. It speaks as well to that biblical concept of reaping what one has surely sown. So we'll take a little break and come back to your phone calls. A couple of lines waiting. Several open if you want to join in the conversation. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Silver Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Total Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Total Genius. We got your soap right here.
And other bath and body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeed. 12 minutes past the hour, going straight to the phones after just a couple of notes. We are getting some good responses to the Horns broadcast of the PRISM West Virginia, PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, West Virginia American History Summer Academy. Chris, known to you as Psychoticus Rex in the chat room, said, I'm looking forward to diving into the history lectures. Listened for a goodly part one morning. Cool. Wish I was in class and could write down notes and ask the prof to expand or give references for some parts. I should have gone to graduate school. Oh, that's what this is, just like going to graduate school. That's how cool it is. William writing in also noting, he says, man, that is one great informative series you've got going on. He also liked the Billikase line with Representative Mo Brooks. What about Billikase? So, it'll go on Tuesday through Friday and then Monday through Thursday of the following week. Just make sure you're there. It's free, and again, I remind you, you can go to ustream.tv and search American History Seminar, and it's all right there for you, live, and every recording has been saved and archived. So let us go straightway to the phones and see what's going on. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Darn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Brother Bob.
Brother Luke, what's up, man?
Well, the last couple of days have been so nice. Unfortunately, summer's about to return again.
Well, this was just, the last couple of days here have just been picture postcard perfect. There's nothing one could complain about.
Well, that dirty word humidity left our vocabulary for a day or two. So.
Yeah, but you know, in our neck of the woods, the complaining about humidity is, well, I mean, it's like complaining about air. It's going to be there.
I know. It's just nice to have a low for a change.
Yeah, true.
Okay, let's get on to what we're
going to do. Because when it does go low, it turns into absolute paradise.
Yes, indeed. Let's get into the business world today, or the cesspool we call politics.
Indeed.
First of all, let's all take a moment and have a moment of silence for Jon Stewart, who now doesn't know what he's going to do now that Glenn Beck's gone.
Oh, he'll find something, I'm sure. But
I know he will, but we were sitting today.
I mean, O'Reilly, you know, let's not kid ourselves. O'Reilly is still insane.
Oh, yeah, and Hannity's there, too, so hey. But we were just talking about the time that he was channeling Beck when he was doing the chalkboards. That was just so perfect.
Well, it was. It absolutely was. And, you know, I have to wonder, was the news cycle too fast? I don't know. Was he working
was he working last night so that he could deal with Mark Halperin's little comment on Morning Joe?
I did not get to see last night. I do not know if he talked about it or not. I know I had to deal with the guest because he had Bill Kristol guest. So I was like, eh. You know how that goes. But, no, it's one of those things that just sort of, you know, you don't really going to have him to kick around anymore. And I saw that last night they were showing somewhere where they were showing face of the crowd.
Yep.
So, but.
I got to get around to seeing that.
Oh, God, you got to. It'll up your respect for Andy Griffith.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's not that I'm found wanting in respect for Andy Griffith.
I know that, but I mean, he was so good. You know what I mean? In a dramatic part.
Yeah, that, and yeah, the respect for his abilities with a drama, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I'm going to talk about, I'll send you something, Mike, last week. You may not have got to it yet. But have you noticed how our beautiful mainstream media, the attentive news people, have totally been ignoring this whole thing over in England about the thing with Mr. Rupert's people listening in on the phone lines?
Yeah, well, you know, that's not newsy.
Well, but the thing of it is, I got thinking about it. Now, could you imagine Rupert at a meeting saying, well, this works in England, so let's not try it in the U.S.? So my question, has anybody in our country thought about checking out some of the phone stuff and see if maybe the boys from Page Six and some of them are involved in something maybe in New York?
Yeah, no kidding.
And you notice that the thing about they moved his son from England to over to America just when all that was starting to fall out because they were afraid Sonny was going to be asked to come in to talk to somebody.
And that could be unpleasant.
Yeah, because apparently this is the one, I think this is the son that he's decided I think is going to take over for him when he retires.
Yeah, have you noticed, Rupert does that the same way Reverend Moon does that. You know, they both do like this, they've got multiple sons and there's an anointing.
Yes, you're the son in favor this month. Yes.
Right, Rupert, Reverend Moon, and Kim Jong, the little guy, platform shoes, North Korea.
But you know, it's just one of those things. I was listening to that story, something on that last week, reading it, and it just amazed me the fact that our press hasn't even thought to ask the question: is this going on in the U.S.? Because, like I say, I just can't imagine Rupert saying this works in England. Let's not try it in the U.S.
I wonder if the penalties are much different.
Well, I don't know, but I know two or three people have sued him and won. And, you know, got retractions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not him directly, but, you know, his different companies.
Yeah, his...
some actresses and actors have sued him and raked him over the coals. So.
Well, more to the party as far as I'm concerned. I've been tied up as heck, Luke. The Prism series is quite well, it's time consuming to say the least, and it keeps me away from the microphone here, and but it's so important. It's so very important that people get or have at least at least the opportunity to avail themselves of this kind of teaching.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where
I've looked forward to this for a year. Since the last one finished.
But that's one of the things I think that liberals do pretty well is they've learned that, you know what, we can't change the people over 50 or 60. Their minds are set. We can chip away at them, but we ain't going to change them. So our best chance to get to them is get to them when they're young. You know, show them what the world is. Don't listen to what they're telling you. Look, go out and take a look for yourself. You know, and once you realize what's going on in the world, you realize I've got to get involved with this.
Yeah, reach, and you know, that's one of the things, you know, this Prism series is very much nonpartisan.
Yeah.
It's nobody's being browbeaten.
Oh,
but the thing is, if you just take the straight facts and the original sources and the primary sources and go to them, then you don't need propaganda because they do the job adequately. Just from a factual standpoint.
But see, that's the thing, you know, the boys over at Faux News and all that, They aren't going to give you facts. They're going to give you their facts.
Oh, I can, you know, I thought about...
aren't the same thing.
As I was sitting there listening to the lectures over the past 3 days, mm-hmm. I sat there from time to time, and I would think... I just sort of imagined Michelle Batshit Crazy Bachman or mm-hmm. Caribou Barbie or Newt Gingrich or any of those other weird freaks sitting over there in the corner as Tom Tierney explained they're all liberals and watching them turn purple in the face and have babies right there on the spot. It was a beautiful thing, the little mental image. Well, it was kind of nasty, too, but yeah, I wouldn't want to be in the room with them.
I know. It's one of those things. I can get into that, but I tell you what, between Bachman and Palin, it's just going to be so much fun. Just sit back and enjoy that for a while. Because I think Palin's realized she shut down at the wrong time.
And don't forget...
Bachman stepped in.
Right, well, you know, but, you know, Mussolini is a...
a fighter.
Well, no, she's not real. She's a reality show personality.
Oh, yeah.
She was never going to run for president. She's still not going to run for president. It's all a hustle. It's all a dodge. It's political three-card Monte. It, you know, it's the same thing that your friend and mine, half-dead Fred Thompson, pulled a few years back. Make a bunch of presidential rumblings, and then after you...
Everybody get interested.
Get them interested, and more importantly, get into their wallets, and then say, you know, I need to spend more time with my family.
We should really question their family and ask them, did you really want him to spend more time with you?
No, we were telling to run. Yeah.
Where are your children? Oh, I don't know. We keep trying to track them down. They keep running every time.
You know, he's got that trophy wife. No, Fred, don't come home. It's okay. I'm right here. I'm all right right here. Don't come home. Him wandering around. Have you ever seen that man naked? Oh, my God.
Well, there went lunch. There went supper.
Yeah. See? Imagine his poor wife.
True enough. But, no, I mean, that's like I say, there's just so many different things going on as of late. You know what I mean? We could get into 20 different things, but such is life.
Yeah. It's, if I wasn't in here, this is therapy. Yeah, on a day like this, at the end of the day, you look up and go, I want a mug about that tall, and I want a plum full with beer, and I want to sit back and relax and... It's good that I'm here.
True enough. I'll tell you what, I'm going to get off and let you go talk to some more people since I know you ain't been on in a while. Let's get talk to some other people, see what's going on in the world.
All right, you have yourself a wonderful weekend and a happy Independence Day, Luke.
We hope. All right,
see you. All right, bye now. That's Brother Luke calling from the hills of East Tennessee. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, so, listen, I can't believe that, they got these four people in this boat in a barbed wire docking area in Greece with guns pointed to them. It's just kind of like, I guess that is the power of the nonviolent movement, you know? I mean, someone's lost their damn mind. It's like, it's a bad place for Greece. You know, they can't really deny anybody at this point. Since, you know what I'm saying? IMF, they're all, I think what the Greeks are doing is bad, but I also think, you know, they got a gun to their head big time.
Oh, yeah.
The pressure is on, and it's just kind of hideous because they are, you know, stopping this boat with some letters. I mean, think about that.
They're not carrying cement, 2x4s, roofing nails. They got letters of support. But did you notice the response of the Obama administration?
I don't even want to know. What is it? I just am looking at the Israeli media. That's where I'm getting this information from. Anyway, why?
Through the State Department, the Obama administration has said, let's see, here it is. This is from an alternate story. Though the flotilla organizers have made clear that the U.S. boat is only carrying letters of support for the people of Gaza, the State Department has also threatened participants with, quote, fines and incarceration if they attempt to provide, quote, material support or other resources to or for the benefit of a designated foreign terrorist organization such as Hamas.
Well, no, but the thing is that, I mean, I was listening to Alice, you know, she just made some incredibly powerful statements, which just sort of took me back to the 80s, you know, when we had constructive engagement with South Africa. It was just like a flashback. This is exactly, maybe 1986 or 85 when, you know, a serious push was being made to end apartheid. And it's just kind of like, you know, some of the things that she was saying, it's just like, damn, you know, I know the Israelis and the U.S. is freaking out because she is a powerful spokesperson for this thing now. And the Israelis must be freaking out because Alice Walker and that other lady, the Holocaust survivor. I mean, this is some serious folks.
Anne Wright is on that boat.
Yeah, and also the Israeli ex pilot guy, and it's just like, wow, you know what I'm saying?
The only thing is, Sandra, I don't know if the Israelis are freaking out. They're just sitting back saying, look, we've got carte blanche to kill your ass the minute we decide to kill your ass, and nobody on planet Earth will do a damn thing about it.
Well, yeah, no, I understand that, but I do think that there is something to be said for making comparison to, you know, one row of people after another, like the Freedom Riders, you know, they just...
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely,
and I do
absolutely.
Think that's a powerful meme, and I can see it being a real problem for both powers, along with them not having full control over the message now. That's a
well, I mean, honest to Jesus, is it really necessary for Obama's State Department to declare that Israel has the right to detain and board
itself.
The ships based on Israeli territorial waters that aren't there?
Yeah, no, it's not theirs. I mean, it's just, no, but it's just so incredible. I mean, this situation, just looking at it, sort of evolved with the background of everyone freaking out in Greece now. It ain't no anarchists and youth. You got middle-aged people, 50-year-olds, grandmothers. The problem in Greece now is that the people aren't being represented by nobody. That's a huge problem. I don't care if they pass bullshit, because there's no way that they're going to pay the debt. If you just look at what's due over the next 2 years, it ain't going to happen. So the Greeks are going to have to allow their whole country to be picked. They did an enabling law, and it's called an enabling law. I was shaking my head thinking, God damn, this ain't no joke. But in the background of this, you have these people trying to go to Gaza. I mean, it must be just a sort of just over the top, you know, in Athens with all this going down. Because I was looking at some of those riots. Wow, people are really done. And I just don't know. I feel so bad because the government has turned on them totally. They have turned on the people. Their standard of living has been destroyed. It's over.
I read, Ibid from the chat room sent me a link a few nights ago, and I started reading it, and it was just, mind-blowing. It's from a WordPress blog called Democracy versus Mythology, The Battle in Syntagma Square.
Yeah.
Talking about what's going on in Greece. And there are stories in there of, you know, 80-year-old people moving back to the country to to garden a little plot of ground so that they won't starve, so that some German or French banker can keep having lobster for lunch.
Well, no, it's just a direct transfer from the taxpayer to the bankers. I mean, there's nothing in between. I mean, they are literally saying, oh, well, you need to give up everything now. 30% off the top of their salaries right away. 30% is what these people are losing.
Yeah.
To have a job. It's incredible, and the thing that's really disturbing is that they're acting like people have forgotten what happened in 2008, Bob. This is what's killing me. It's like, what planet are these people on? Everyone knows that they paid off these bankers trillions, shifted all of debt onto the public books, and now they're trying to pretend, oh, well, we have to, you know, self-sacrifice. I mean, are they kidding with this shit? That's why people are in the streets, you know, because they know. They know. You don't have teachers in England striking. That ain't normal. That shit is off the hook, too.
And but they can strike.
Well, no, they can, but they can't do, it has to be a certain type of strike.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as bad as what we have here. But they are sort of walking a fine line. And the thing that's interesting about England is that you have every party there saying it's bad. Once again, the people are no longer being even the pretense of representation. But the people there, they know that they're being fucked over. See, so I'm not too sure, you know, what's going to go down. I mean, Europe is just sort of interesting to look at because it's all going down. You see what I mean?
Well, I hate the fact, Sandra, that I've tried to educate myself on Greece more than I have been because I felt like I was being deficient, and I keep coming back to this notion that there is an element in the world, not just any given country, but there is an element in the world that wants to destroy the social safety net for the entire world, and it doesn't matter to them where they start. Greece will do nicely, because if they make that go away, then all that money going into the social safety net, as is happening in Greece, goes into their pockets instead.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the whole thing, but, the thing is, they all seem to be forgetting, and which is what is disturbing to me, is just the generalized history of Europe. You know, it ain't pretty. And so, if you destroy people's economic wherewithal, they have a tendency to drift into war over there. We've seen it, and we know their history. You know what I mean? I mean, listen, European history, 30-year war, 100-year war, just war. So I ain't sitting here thinking that there's no reason for that to not return if the social democracy falls apart, because the reason for the social democracy was because the whole place was destroyed, and they said, shit. And they built something different. Now, they want to take it apart. And I'm not too sure what they think is going to follow. Because humans don't change just because we got Facebook, you know?
Statement of the night. Absolutely.
You know, I'm like, what the fuck? Anyway.
Well, you know, this blog I was talking about, the author recounts and says, my mother, who is nearly 70, who worked all her life for the archaeology department of the Ministry of Culture in Greece, who paid tax, national insurance, and pension contributions for over 45 years, deducted at the source, has had her pension cut to less than £400 a month. She faces the same rampantly inflationary energy and food prices as the rest of Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, the thing is, it's just stunning. You know, in the background of these fucking elites and bankers getting 100% on the dollar, and it's just like, you know, it's a construct. We don't, you know, the people don't have to agree to these terms. That's the thing. And because it's been so distorted, it's stunning to me that they still are able to get the agreements like they are. I just can't see it lasting for that much longer. Take our situation. The fact that they were floating this 14th Amendment bullshit out here is hella funny. And with Obama killing Bin Laden and all this shit, they might say it's a national interest issue. Fuck you, Congress. We gonna pay the bills. I don't know what Obama's gonna do. We know. Remember him? I'm scared. You should be too.
Hear, hear.
You know, it's like economic destruction can easily be turned into a state issue of national interest, and all of a sudden, that has been taken over by the executive branch. So Congress, watch out.
Well, but is Congress even interested? At every turn, it seems in recent history, Congress has found itself eagerly ceding its own authority to the executive.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking, because this is just so over the top. Here we are in July, And, you know, we keep being told all this bullshit with the debt thing, which, once again, you know, I how I feel about it. I find the whole thing very dubious in light of the trillions that have been shoveled to the financial sector. And all of a sudden, now we got to be concerned about it? Why?
Because they figured out there's a little bit more money to squeeze out of us?
Well, it's just a joke. It's like, if a people... You know, what's that saying? You can fool people some of the time or whatever. You know what I mean?
All of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but not all of the people all of the time?
Right, and we're in that paradigm. It's just, you know, because I'm just shaking my head thinking, the 14th Amendment? You know, what are you talking about? You know? Also, why in the world, you know, would they, you know, crashing it? You know it's going to be a disaster because the interest rates will be going up, you know. It's just going to be a nightmare. It's just not good. But I don't think it has to happen. That's the thing.
But looking at Greece, for instance, Sandra, what's the, you know, this is a stirring example of, stunning example of an abject failure of politics, because that's a socialist government that's doing all of this knuckling under to the European banking.
Yeah.
Cartels, and so there's an opposition conservative movement that, and so if they get rid of the socialists, they get those guys.
Well, see, but that's
what happens then. I mean,
I don't think that the sort of elites are just kind of detached to the point where it's very dangerous. That's all. I don't, you know, the people who don't want to raise taxes, the right, and then you have the left. You know, none of it is speaking to those middle-aged people out in the street, you see? I mean, that's where you have a dangerous mix. What do you have, the petty bourgeoisie along with the poor? We know what that turns into.
Well, and exactly, because no revolution based upon discontent of the poor has ever succeeded. But when the bourgeoisie and the middle class get involved, everything changes. And you know, whether it's what happened in Great Britain with the ascendancy of the conservatives there, or you know, this kind of the same thing happened in Australia, or Greece, the failure of the socialistic government in Spain, and you wind up you can't help looking at it and saying, you know, Jesus, the people are going out of the frying pan and into the fire, and neither of them ultimately have a solution, and. I mean, are we in some sort of undiscovered country where where all of the political considerations of, you know, as I've been immersed in for the last couple of days, of the last 400 years are just doesn't work anymore, doesn't count, doesn't matter, it has been proven dead wrong?
I mean, it's just stunning. It's just such a stunning moment to be looking at, because. And it's just not rational. You know, the whole sort of, when they talk about capitalism in this cancerous stage, I mean, it seems like this is it. And the fact that it's all, you know, going down in Greece, it's just, I don't know if it's ironic, I don't know what the hell it is, but, you know, you can think of Plutarch and, you know, the sort of greats out of that part of the world, and you're like, wow, it's come full circle. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know how the Greek people are going to manage it, you know, but this is the first social, you know, modern social democracy that's being destroyed in Europe. So I'm not too sure which way it's going to go.
And like I said, I just keep looking up and, you know, to use the old Latin phrase, cui bono, you know, to whom the good, who benefits, for whom is this, and you know, we've talked about the banking interests in Germany and the banking interests in France. How can so narrowly a defined group utterly destroy an entire country?
Well, and also I think they're really cutting their nose off, because, like I said before in a conversation we had, you know, that there are sort of elites who envision a permanent deepening of this experiment. But this is not the way to get to it, because they're completely undermining whatever authority or, you know, the Europeans are not going to respect Brussels. I mean, it's, you know, difficult on the best day. But right now, I'm pretty sure your average European is sort of looking at this and thinking, oh, no, you know, this is making me poorer. You know what I mean?
What, and you know, if you're France and Germany, how do you, if you're middle class or lower class, how do you not look up and, especially, you know, lower class and social safety net, that kind of stuff, how do you not look up and go, what happens when it come, when they come for me?
Well, right, and the sort of mercantilism that Germany is sort of trying to hold on to is at risk, too. I mean, you know, it's just sort of, it's just a really a big mess. But
I mean, what does happen if these giant banks in France and Germany, you know, who are basically the guts behind the euro, what happens if it all goes sideways? What happens to Europe as a whole?
Well, that's the thing. That's what you have to worry about. And you know that it's a real, that people are freaking out because the two banks in Germany and France have sort of agreed to roll over some of it. It's all on a QT. Which is interesting because that's a sort of a soft restructuring. So, I mean, they're not completely oblivious to it, but they don't have the sort of people in mind. They don't give a F about them. That's what's really disturbing to me. I don't know. I'm sort of like, I can't, you know, I don't know. When the people are in the streets like that, I mean, you know, wake up. You got a problem, right?
Well, a bigger one than I think maybe, I can't make my head understand, Sandra, how a bunch of people in suits in Bonn or Paris or Berlin look at people in the streets in Greece and say, well, you know, it won't get out of hand, it won't get out of Greece. You know? Ah, you know, they'll bring out the guys with the rubber bullets and the water hoses, and everything will calm down. It'll be okay.
Listen,
because at this point, it seems like that's magical thinking, and you know what I mean by that phrase.
Yeah, no, for sure, especially when you know, 6 months from now, what kind of conversation, you know, are we going to be having about the EU? But listen, I have to bring up this sort of, you know where I'm going to go, hello, that fire is in that canyon now, where all the old radioactive shit from the Manhattan Project on up. I mean, what's happening? I don't mean to laugh, but, oh, it's no problem. We're being told, no danger, it's all fine. Come on.
Because that stuff doesn't burn?
I know, but the plutonium?
No, that's what I'm asking. What, yeah, no problem because it doesn't burn? No problem because it's got, you know, the 80-foot walls of steel around it?
Action speaks louder. When I saw that traffic jam, I'm like, damn, Skippy. Okay?
Yeah, goodbye.
It's just kind of like, when they said, oh, my God, the fire is behaving like I've never seen before. It's burning trees that were burnt 10 years ago. How is this possible? Then I'm thinking, what fucking experiments have been going on there, Bob? God knows.
You know, when Robin the Bat Boy comes flying out, you know, we'll realize that the Weekly World News was not just a tabloid.
I don't know. I just, you know, I don't even, you know, I'm so sort of stupefied by the shit that's going on all at once, you know, and, you know, in the meanwhile.
And have you noticed, and, you know, we don't cut him any slack, but have you noticed that the right wing has declared that the fires in Texas and New Mexico are Barack Obama's fault? It's a beautiful thing. You know, just in terms of...
How is it his fault?
Well, no, it just is. It just is. If that asteroid that passed close to the Earth a few nights ago had gotten a little bit closer, asteroid would have been Obama's fault, too. I forget, we were driving back to campus last night, and I was looking... I was actually trying to find NPR, and I was down on the low end of the FM dial where NPR lives around here, you know, 89.5 and stuff like that. And I landed on something where people were talking. I thought, oh, NPR. But it turned out to be this right-wing guy who was talking about the heroic actions of Rick Goodhair Perry in responding to the fires in Texas while Barack Obama has let Texas burn because we know he don't care about us.
Well, I thought he was a dick. So what's the problem?
Well, there's that too. Right.
Then, you know, I mean, to me, you know how I am, how I feel about Obama. There is no love lost. But let me tell you something. We got to circle the wagon sometimes. A dick? What in the fuck? How you going to call the press? You know,
I mean, that's the kind of language we use here. We're not professional, highly paid, multimillionaire broadcasters or nothing, Sandra.
No, not only that, but it just speaks to the whole sort of assumptions about what they can say about this man. And I can't help but think because it's black, you know, and it's sort of like these fucking white men are so, they got so many issues, and it just bubbles up. You know what I mean? And that Halperin, he's disgusting. You know what I mean?
Oh, he's a sick bastard and has been for a long, long time.
I never liked him. And it's just like, oh, dude, you know, did he get fired? I mean, I know. And
He was suspended indefinitely.
Oh, no. And I was so disturbed when the White House responded. It's like, don't do that. You know, stop.
Just hush. Sometimes we don't.
Stop it.
Sometimes we don't have to respond.
They responded, though, and it was just like, oh, no.
But see, that brought me back to my long-running thesis that sooner or later the sort of Jungian psychosocial pressure is going to build up so big. So, you know, it's going to be like that moment where the air inside the balloon is just too concentrated and the skin of the balloon can't take it anymore. And when I heard the Mark Halperin thing, Sandra, I just thought, one of these Republicans is just going to come out and say the word one of these days.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. No, I am.
And it's going to be like Tourette's. He's not going to say it once.
He's gonna
start speaking N-word tongues. I mean, he's rolling on the floor and
we got a little taste of that with Dr. Laura. Remember? She got good.
Yes.
I'm like, damn.
Yes. There is a Dr. Laura moment coming. I don't know whether it's for Rick Perry or for Michelle Bachman. Come on. She's an Oral Roberts grad. Sarah Palin? But it's coming. It is coming.
Yeah, no, because it's just, you know, it's too much for him, you know, and it's just kind of like Obama, you know, just said, oh, you know, they can still fly their jets, and these Republicans are freaking out. And, you know, I'm sitting there freaking out because is that the best you can do? You know, and it's just kind of like, oh, it's just incredible. I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? I mean, how are they going to, this man barely pipes up, and it's just sort of an onslaught.
Yeah, and again, I'm not kidding. Blaming him, you know, he don't love Texas. And just today, I got to tell you this. It's visual, but bear with me. So for a year or more now, there's been this billboard out on I-77 that says, "Tell the Obama administration EPA to stop its war on coal." Okay? Well, they've got a new one. And it's an outline done in red of West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, and it says the Obama administration war zone. Tell the Obama EPA not to take away our jobs. Coal is Appalachia, or some equivalent line of unmitigated, unrestrained horse shit. But these right wingers, and make no mistake that when you're talking about the Coal Association or the Mining Association or Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, Virginia Coal Association, these are all dyed in the wool right wing outfits. Okay? There's nothing centrist, there's nothing nonpartisan about them. They're right, and again, Obama's at war with you. You know what? They'd never say that about a white man.
No, I mean, it's just, no, the whole thing is just, and of course, you know, and this is, you know, I have to have a lot of sympathy, and like I say about circling the wagons, because it's just like, oh, no, there is no level playing field for this man. He's the president of the fucking USA. You see what I mean? I can't get past that. And he still, you know, is subjected to the type of name calling and discussion that we know would never happen if it was Hutzman in there or whoever the
no
person. And it's so distracting from things like this. For example, the fact that Jamie Dimon has been discussed as a possible replacement for Geithner. You see what I'm saying?
Here it comes.
It's like, hello? Dimon, can you believe how hideous that is? He's considered a strong, dark horse candidate. I'm like, oh, my God.
That's just creepy. That's real creepy. By the way, but I have to ask you, because you sent this story to me a couple of weeks ago, Sandra, and it has come back up into conversation. This don't be pregnant in Alabama or Mississippi business. Have you seen this?
No, uh-uh. What? No,
in the state of Alabama, at least 40 cases have been brought against women who had miscarriages.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a whole article about how it's just this criminalizing pregnancy that's just going on here. It's out of control.
Let's see. Here's the story of Amanda Kimbrough. Her baby was delivered by cesarean section prematurely in April 2008. The baby died 19 minutes after birth. 6 months later, they arrested Ms. Kimbrough and charged her with chemical endangerment of her unborn child on the grounds that she had taken drugs during pregnancy. Now, she denied the claim. There's another case where the woman, yes, she had a cocaine problem, but the medical examiner himself said that didn't contribute to the miscarriage. Stop them in Alabama.
No, I mean, either you have full control over your body or you don't. You see, I mean, I'm not like sort of, saying that, oh God, it's okay for you to sit there and smoke crack when you're 8 months pregnant, but I don't know. I just see it as, it's too much. What about that poor woman who fell down the stairs and they thought that she threw herself down the stairs?
Yeah.
They had her in jail for a bit.
I mean, this Kimbrough woman is going to do 10 hard.
Is that what? I mean, I didn't know that that it had. I had vaguely heard about that case.
Yeah, she was convicted.
Oh, my God.
And unless her case is reversed on appeal, and this is Alabama, she is going to do 10 hard for a baby dying outside her womb that nothing she did contributed to its demise.
Listen, I don't mean to be glib, but they need to shift the prison resources because, there's pressure to wind down the war on drugs, but I figure they'll have the prisons ready for debt and now, I guess, pregnancy. So they'll have plenty of replacements.
And the thing is, and it doesn't, it doesn't really rise to it doesn't rise that high on the oh shit meter, even on our side of it. There are 38 states out of 50, Sandra.
Yeah, but look at
that. Have fetal homicide laws.
No, but ain't it the kind of women though? It's because ain't it mostly people of women of color and poor women?
Always.
Well, so that's why it's not going to rise on our side. Let's be honest. Our side has some class issues, too.
What I can't
believe is the sort of the creeping destruction of Planned Parenthood. I mean, it seemed to be going as planned.
Oh, it is. And this is all part of one great big set piece. Like these fetal homicide laws. Things were, I remember when they were all the rage in all the state legislatures 10 years or so, ago or so, and they were specifically offered by the Right to Life movement as enhancements to sentences for third-party attackers who had wounded or killed a fetus during the course of an attack on a pregnant woman. And we're just recognizing the life in the womb. That's all we're doing. And so these things are designed to be used on third-party attackers. But now and remember, the Right to Life movement is the same bunch of enablers that, you know, allow all of this crap to happen in the Confederacy. They exactly what people who opposed those bills, and it was really hard to oppose them, Sandra, because, well, what, don't you want to protect the little fetuses? What kind of sick-ass monster are you? Because it was so hard to contest, but those who did said, listen, this is going to end poorly. And here it is, because they did not use it for its intended purpose. This was another one of those right-wing camel's nose under the tent laws, and it's right where they intended it to be, because they want to, you know, there is, God, it's like a sick, sadistic, thrill for the right wing to get to take a big old dump on poor folks and folks of color, especially the women folks.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, there's a breaking news. A judge blocked the Kansas law because, you know, there was going to only be one place in Kansas where you could get an abortion if all that shit went down, but they blocked it. So, you know, so far they can't...
You know, God, there's something like 20 states that have gone all in for these fetal pain laws.
Oh, yeah, and the heartbeat business, and it just goes on and on, and the sonogram hell.
But, I mean, don't you have to have a functioning brain to feel pain?
Oh, you know, no, it's just a bunch of BS, you know. I have to agree with Malloy when he said, you know, just the framing it as choice is wrong when it should just be right to privacy. I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, because you take it completely out of the realm of anything but what someone's doing, a Fourth Amendment issue, you know?
It doesn't seem that hard to comprehend, but if you frame it that way, the right-wingers can't win.
No, I know, and you know, yeah, it's just too much, but the sort of, the women's bodies as a battlefield, that is so true, you know?
And, you know, again, you know, kind of what we were talking about with Greece and Europe, where does this end? Because these people never give up. They and you know, our side has this problem. You see it in the Obama administration. You know, that well, you know, if we just make one more overture to them, we can appeal to reason. You know, let us reason together and sit down and, you know, here, have a hit on the hookah. And you want to play the tambourine a little bit?
Well, actually, you know, I kind of think that, I don't know if it's, you know, it's not in our interest. I think that there's some real money interest that's starting to kind of freak out about what's going down in Washington, because Chucky Schumer came out and actually said it out loud that the Republicans are trying to destroy the economy. They're basically saying it now. And it's just like, damn, welcome to the party, fool.
Isn't it, you know, it's almost as satisfying as watching that last scene of The Miracle Worker where Helen Keller gets the water on her hands and says, water. You know, because, you know, inside what Jim calls the Forbidden City, there's this wholly unwarranted belief that, you know, we've just got a difference of opinion with them, but we're all in the same boat together. We're all Americans. We all love the same. They don't.
Yeah,
they don't.
Well, yeah,
and
no.
They really are held. You know, this business with the debt ceiling, you know, you and I have discussed that. And there's an open question as to what happens if it doesn't get raised. The fact that Wall Street is beginning to shit bricks tells me a little bit about their take on it.
Well, it just, like I said, I mean, it'll be bad all around, that's for sure. But as Dean Baker said, Wall Street will be destroyed. That's the thing, you know. That is the thing.
And I mean, do these crazy ass people like Michelle Bachmann? I mean, can they really, really stare into the abyss and withstand it when the abyss stares back?
Well, that's why you get someone like Chuck Schumer, who is about as wedded as you can be. There is very little daylight between him and Wall Street. And for him to roll out like that and say that, and then, you know, Obama and Geithner, especially Geithner, reading the 14th Amendment out loud in places, I'm telling you. You see what I'm saying? So somebody is upset that don't have nothing to do with us. We don't matter.
No.
We matter. There's some sort of battle among the elites. Let's look at it like that.
Yeah, kind of like back when we were kids, and Sunday afternoons would be devoted to Battle of the Network Stars.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
anyway,
we're not them, and we ain't in Hawaii.
Right, but I mean, the whole 14th Amendment BS is really making me laugh, but the only thing that's kind of disturbing to me, though, is for the power of the executive branch to encroach like this. You know, it's kind of FDR-ish, but not in the way that we would like it to be, I think.
No.
You see what I mean? Because that's what FDR did. FDR was like, I'm going to just go again. The Constitution went bye-bye with FDR. We know this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Out the window. Bye-bye. But, hey, you know, what was he trying to do, you know? But, see, unfortunately...
Oh, he was trying to stave off revolution.
Right.
Even though the elites called him a traitor to his class... He was actually trying to save their white asses.
Saving their asses.
And they didn't even have the common decency to be grateful.
Right, but I mean, you know, I'm just saying, but unfortunately, I just don't, you know, I don't get the feeling that everybody is on the same page with what's going down here.
No, and I got to ask you, Sandra, are you all dialed into the present Kabuki theater over Dominique Strauss-Kahn?
Listen,
I know you had to feel a little vindicated.
Oh, snap on that shit. Wow. What can I say? I was like, yikes. And more disturbing is that Sarkozy is like, damn, these people don't play around.
Oh, I think Sarkozy was, damn, yeah, missed it by this much.
So the thing is that the prosecutor, they're the ones who are sort of pulling back too, aren't they?
Yeah, it's the prosecutor's office because I love the reasoning behind it. The initial rumbling said, well, listen, there's definitely physical evidence of sexual encounter.
Right.
You know, that's legal code for we have the stained blue dress.
Oh, have they just discovered that the woman's black? Bob,
God, I hate it when you do that to me.
Listen, you know, come on. I mean, the whole thing is just disgusting. But
What I love is that we're having real problems because she has been caught in several lies now, and she won't tell the truth about her associations with a known drug dealer.
Right. Okay. So that's what I'm saying. It's just kind of like, come on. I don't know.
No, I keep hearing that little chord from Law and Order that thum thum, and I see what's his name in the office with the prosecutor who always loses. What's his name? Ben something. And he goes, I can't take this to trial. She's untruthful. She won't tell us about what kind of a junkie she is, and she's lied about. Well, of course you're going to lie about being a junkie. What does that have to do with whether or not he forced himself on her?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I mean about it. And the whole thing is that, you know, oh, what? Now all of a sudden, anyone who claims any kind of rape or sexual assault, you know, you have to be some sort of pristine.
You have to be a nun?
Right, to get any sort of traction. That's
preferably a white nun.
It's, you know, the same as those police that got away with raping that woman who was drunk. Well, she was drunk, so she deserved that, really.
Right, right.
You
know
what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the message taken from there. But yeah, I the thing is, and then they have that sort of proto-fascist Lagarde that they appointed, that woman. Have you seen that?
Yes.
You know,
she's awful.
Her vicious, her face is like, hello? Yeah, anyway, yeah, she's bugging me. I'm thinking, she's the one that immediately demanded that the Greeks must pass this, that, or another. So, you know,
that weak-kneed little American-born Papandreou, this guy was born an American raised, right? American schooled. What happened?
His family has been in control of Greece for like, what, 3 or 4 generations? I mean, anyway.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but somewhere along the way, a little something had to rub off. When somebody like that looks at you and says, you must do this or else... You know, whatever happened to stepping up and saying, or else what? You're sending your armies? You're gonna bomb us? You're gonna drop a bunker buster on the Acropolis? What?
Exactly. And you know, where are the sort of Greek generals now? I'm sorry, I don't mean to advocate, but you know, I'm like,
no, but I mean, this ain't Afghanistan. This is the Acropolis. This is the birthplace of Western civilization. This isn't the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan. What are you gonna do? Blow them up?
Yeah, no.
But meanwhile, as that one article I read noted, I mean, there's been some creepy stuff come out. One of the things that the author notes is that the Chinese have chimed in.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Chinese are supposed to save the euro.
Well, because a third of their investments are in euros.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's...
So they've, the Chinese, I mean, just revel, Sandra, in the ludicrous irony of this. The communist Chinese have suggested privatizing the Acropolis.
Yeah, and they want...
I don't know, maybe putting mouse ears on Athena Parthenos. Who knows?
They want Crete. I don't know. You know, see, I spent 2.5 weeks in Greece, you know, so I'm kind of like, it's just so sad to me. I love the trip that I took. It was amazing. People were amazing. All that.
Oh, I know. From the time I was little tiny, I've wanted to go.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. I went to some of the islands. We were just kind of like, what the hell? And, you know, so it saddens me.
And, I want to, to this day, my traveling urge. I never got it out of my system. I want to go to Crete so bad I could cry.
I
want to go there for a month and eat the Mediterranean diet and watch my triglycerides just go, what triglycerides?
Oh, no, I mean, the food, yeah, I mean, we, you know.
And wander around in the palace of Knossos. And revel in that Minoan culture that doesn't get half the, you know, we still haven't translated their language.
Wow.
They invented writing entirely separate from the invention of writing that happened in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, no.
And then one good earthquake and everything goes to hell.
Well, no, and Crete is one of the, you know, they keep talking about that as, you know, one of the sort of, it's you know, one of the jewels that's up for grabs. And it's just like, are you kidding me with this?
Who are we going? I mean, China wants to privatize it. Who's going to buy it?
Well, no, but the thing is, this is the problem. The whole plan is just ludicrous. When you look at it a couple of years down, it's like, yeah, right. Who's going to enforce this?
You know, in that movie, The Last Mountain, Bobby Kennedy, and I've heard him talk about it in other instances as well. He talks about the fact that, and he's talking about, you know, the coal companies, but the same can be said for a lot of. Predatory capitalism. He said they are. He says of, for instance, Massey Energy, that they are treating the state of West Virginia as a business in liquidation.
Right. Yeah. And I heard him talking about how the whole state is. Just
and that's. But that's the same thing with Greece. The global predatory capitalist community is looking at Greece as a business in liquidation, and so if your real business goes into liquidation, you know, the guys in the coveralls come and carry out the computers and the copiers and the desk chairs and the little plastic things the desk chairs roll on that have the spikes on the bottom and all of that stuff, they carry it away. Well, what do you do when it's the entire patrimony of Western civilization? I mean,
well, the other problem with the whole privatization fantasy island world is you got to have a level of state capacity to carry that shit off. And by virtue of doing it, destroy state capacity and state autonomy. So good luck.
Well, and when it comes time to carry that off, don't you kind of have to have the people in the matching costumes with with the set piece artillery and that kind of stuff behind you?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Good luck with that. I'm telling you. I just think that it's not going to work, and it's just going to be horrible for the Greek people, I think, for a while. But anyway, I'll let you go. I must point out we got to support Governor Mark Dayton because he's like somebody.
Oh, said, golly Moses.
Shut that shit down, bitches. But we'll see how that plays out because I was surprised. I'm like,
I hope to God
okay.
He doesn't blink.
I was like, damn, no, he didn't. So I don't know what the Republicans want there because I have.
Well, do you think Barack Obama and his people might be watching this?
Take a lesson.
Because you've got to learn not to blink.
Take a page because apparently it's sort of like, okay, well, see ya. And I haven't seen any sort of movement towards coming back to the table on this one, too, so.
Well, I'm going to, at some point, I will email you this blog from this Greek writer, because I just wandered around among all these articles. And this is, you know, real man on the street kind of writing. But I love, you know, I love these titles, like, to whom do we owe this money exactly?
Yeah. Is it worth it? You know, what the IMF and the European Bank is doing. You see what I mean? That's what I mean.
Didn't Ecuador kind of say?
Oh, Ecuador did say, yeah. They said, see ya. I forgot the name of the president, he said, no, you want this. And they brought an audit in, and they audited it and said, no, we're paying this, this, and this, and we're not paying this and this, and fuck you. And the IMF had to go away. The IMF was in disarray until this 2008 business happened. Then they came back.
Yeah. And
yeah, no.
But we can't have that taken hold now, can we?
Anyway, but I am sort of a bit fearful about how this debt thing is going to play out here, though. I don't even know what to think.
I don't either, because, you know, my gut says that language like the full faith and credit of the United States actually matters. But on the other hand, if the people taking the haircut are the shitbirds on Wall Street, and, you know, their argument's going to be, well, you know, it will filter down. Well, damn, well, you know, all that TARP money sure didn't filter. Now, did it?
It filtered down from now. I mean, I'm just saying, it's sort of, you know, that argument is getting weaker and weaker by the moment, along with, oh, we can't tax the job creators. You know, I'm about to get sick hearing that. You know what I mean? It's just such a joke.
Well, you know, can we not just have a degree of honesty in the discourse, Sandra? They don't get to be called job creators until they don't get to be called job creators until they create some jobs.
Well, and that organ snatcher is lobbying hard to get the forgiveness.
Oh,
Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah, I know.
All despicable. But listen, and you know things are just control because that Eric Cantor can actually have short the Treasury.
Oh, I saw that, and even what? cynical me went, no, really, no.
But the thing is, though, he's still in his position, though. This is the thing you need to take note. This shit comes out, we're completely gobsmacked, and it just goes on to the next day.
Yeah, Eric can't
stay in place.
Yeah, has there been a reference to the House Ethics Committee? No, I didn't think so. No,
nothing.
The guy is heavily invested in
shorting
treasury bills,
and his only response is that, well, it's just a way of balancing my portfolio. Yeah,
no, because
what do I balance my five Intel stocks with? You know, come on now.
Well, but beyond that, you know, this guy's a member of Congress,
and you do not.
Now, I mean, I understand bonds are not for somebody who wants to make a profit, because, you know, bonds often don't even keep up with inflation. I had to learn that lesson once.
Unless you buy the inflation protected ones.
Right. You don't hold bonds as a means of making money. You hold bonds as a means of just tucking money away, as savings. So when you and when we're talking about treasury bills, we're talking about something that has until recently been considered the single most solid, sound, reputable, rock-ribbed, blue-chip the repository of your cash on the planet. The point that I'm trying to make, Sandra, is that you don't short that because there is no value in shorting that.
Right, that's what I mean about the sort of, you know, the hollow balancing. It's like, no, you're in negotiations to cause some sort of credit event, let's call it that, in this country, and you stand to benefit immensely, and you still are in your job. I even called his office and said something. I couldn't take it. can take it.
Well, it's just too much.
You know,
there's no way you can hide behind this. The only way you short this stuff is if you know that you. It's like insider trading. If you know that you have the power to make that that short bet come true, then that's why you short it. You can't keep a position like that unless you are committed to destroying the full faith and credit of the United States.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's completely transparent what, you know, just how corrupt this dude is, and yet we have to hear Obama talking about, well, we're negotiating with these people. So it makes him look real suspect too.
But why doesn't the Obama administration at least have the stones to point out the mendacity and, in fact, let's go ahead and say it, unpatriotic nature of a position like that? I mean, it left me an absolute stammering, stuttering, oh my God mess. And even considering that this guy's a right winger, I was surprised.
Oh, I know. Listen, my battery's about to die.
All right. I've yammered your ear off. But
that's all right. Listen, take care, and I'll check out the series for sure next week.
Oh, especially these lectures we had last night and today. The Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, Hume, wow.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
All right. Take care.
See you, Sandra. Bye now. Sandra calling from California, and... I don't mean to carry on too much, but yeah, I saw that story about Eric Leave Brittany Alone Cantor holding short positions on Treasury bills, and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ! I mean, that's just one too far. I mean, do you remember? And did we ever get a satisfactory explanation? Let me say this officially. This is not an opening up of the discussion of September 11th. But do you remember that we found out that there were short bets on the airlines impacted September the 11th? Did we ever find out who did the short? No, we didn't. But you only get those short positions when you have a reason to believe that something is going to go horribly, horribly wrong. And Eric Cantor is in the position to make things go horribly, horribly wrong and to profit by them. And yet this is not, you know, we're talking about it on this, you know, this little internet program. Where is the CBS News special report with the, you know, with the scary music behind it? You know, where's Morley Safer and Mike Wallace and with the expose on this? Where's the ferocious questioning by Judas Snuffleupagus? Crickets, you know? Crickets. So, 17 minutes past the hour. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. Last full show for about 2 weeks, because we will continue with the Prism series live from the campus of Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. Amazing content. Do avail yourself. This is stuff that's being just sort of given away for free because of the kindness and open-heartedness and commitment to spreading the availability of education and information that informs the spirit of Dr. Bill O'Brien. Please. You know, I don't have any advertisers out there that make me, you know, I've got to drive up ratings, damn it. That's not what's behind this. Avail yourself of this. These are world-renowned scholars in their fields, teaching you as if you were a tuition-paying student. Doesn't happen every day. Check it out. It'll be live on the Horn stream. Some of it will go up for podcasting. Some of it will go up for... Well, all of it will go up on the Ustream site Just search American History Seminar, and bang, before you get to NAR, it'll pop up. Go there. You can watch it all for free. Yes, we seek contributions here on the Horn. Yes, we badly need them. We fell far short in June, which makes paying July's bills damned difficult. But thank you for those of you who did contribute. We need all the help we can get. I mentioned contributions at the beginning of the program. Not one has rolled in. But that's okay. I mean, people have it tough. I understand. That's why we talk about 250 people giving $10. Because even somebody like me, who's brokered in the Ten Commandments, you can scrounge up $10. You know, there I was walking around Minneapolis. Hey, buddy, can you help me? I just need to get a night, be able to pay for a night in the mission. Whatever. $10 here. Because like I said, you know, you don't get over that all the good stuff they teach you about Christianity in the basement of the Baptist church where the little old blue-haired ladies do the teaching before they take you upstairs and teach you the mean, hateful shit. You've done it under the least of these. You've done it also under me. That stuff has a way of sticking. And so, yeah. But if you can't, you can't. But if you can, please do. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's Richard in Northern California.
Hey, Richard. What's happening, man? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's been a while. I'm what, 2 hours behind you? 3 hours behind you? I can't keep it straight.
That's three.
Huh?
Three.
Three, okay. And, well, got some things on my mind about job creation. And I want to go back. First of all, I wanted to mention I'm behind you. I listen on MP3s, and I'm probably about 2 weeks behind. You recorded a woman. She had an Indian name? American Indian?
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about offhand. It's been a very busy...
She spoke not far from you. You went and did a remote. I was going to call it Geronimo, and I know it's...
Oh, no, that was her, India Geronimo. No, she's not an American Indian woman.
Oh, yeah.
She's an African-American woman.
She received a Marvin Karpatkin Award.
Yes, India Geronimo.
Yeah. Well, I knew Marvin Karpatkin. He was my draft lawyer.
Wow.
Yeah. And he sort of pops up every once in a while. You know, his daughter ran Consumer Reports, and he's a good guy. I was a conscientious objector, or I was going to be, for Vietnam, but then I found out that the Army didn't want me either. You know?
Lucky you.
Huh?
Lucky you.
Well, I wasn't really, because it stunned me. I was so geared up to fight them that when I got the letter in the mail that said year one Y, I was absolutely stunned. It's like I didn't know what to do with myself. It's probably the reason why I went back to graduate school.
Just a matter. Well, you know. Definitions of adulthood are arbitrary at best. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up.
I am too, and I'm 69. How about that?
You know what? That may not be a bad thing, Richard.
Yeah, it may not be. I've had an interesting work life. Very interesting. You know, I sure didn't save a lot of money doing it, but wow, it's been interesting. It's been quite.
But you know what? That's one of those false paradigms. That money is not the measure of success in life. It cannot be, or else life becomes a very meaningless event for a whole bunch of people who have done a heck of a lot with their existence.
I know, and I think that's where you're at. And what can I say?
Well, no, that's. I mean, no. I mean, I'm never going to get rich doing this. but, you know, you also have to acknowledge the other side of that coin, and that is that sometimes money is a bit of a necessity because I can't go and barter, well, let's see, don't have the good looks. No, I can't go and barter for enough asphalt shingles, tar paper, and wood to rebuild my roof.
Your roof, yes. We need to have a picture of your roof.
Oh, let's don't.
On the website.
No, really, that's kind of embarrassing, okay?
It's like the symbol of your of what you do.
No, because last year, you know, we had an absolute crisis that surrounded my septic system, and the Horn family responded generously and magnanimously on to that, so that we could keep my ass out of jail. This time through, nobody's threatening to put me in the pokey, so I'm going to kind of leave it alone. But yeah, you know, it rains in the bedroom. And everybody, well, Bob put up a tarp. You know, Bob has put up a tarp. Bob's put up two or three tarps.
Wet spot, right?
Well, stop that. You know, I put up several tarps. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this house is 80 years old, and so is the wood underneath the shingles, which means it won't hold a nail anymore.
Oh, that's too bad.
I mean, it's all got to be redone. It's a huge job. But, you know, I can tarp till hell freezes over, but, you know, the tarp blows away and the rain comes in.
Well, hey, listen, I got a story for you about jobs. Back when I was quite young, I was attending a conservatory called the Manus College of Music. And the Manus College of Music was a very small conservatory, so small that it only had 50 students on full time and another 50 on it.
Jesus, that's barely enough for a marching band, Richard.
It was a fantastic school.
I'm being facetious.
Well, two musicians happened to have been the inventors of the best color film ever to exist, which was Kodachrome. And they were young musicians, and David Manus was one of them.
Wow.
So the Manus College of Music, you know, was the recipient of a fairly good amount of Kodak money. Now, money was also coming in from IBM. You know, I don't know why, but it was. And I got interested, you know, because I knew where the funding was coming from. I got interested in, you know, in these two companies. And one day, the president of IBM said that he was worried about the consequences of the automation that his company was generating. That computers were going to put so many people out of work that it would have to be faced, the problem would have to be faced as a large universal effort. Did I explain that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, he put that out there into the universe. Well, here it is all these years later, and, you know, we have, I don't know what our real inflation rate is, I mean, joblessness rate is, because, you know, we get these smoke and mirrors figures out of the government. They're meaningless. You know, you count the people who have applied for unemployment insurance and tell with everybody else.
Well, you don't count the people who have exhausted their unemployment insurance. You don't count the people who have been who have been unemployed long enough to, they're just classified as depressed workers.
Exactly.
They just need a pill.
I'm going to estimate that the rate is something around 22%. Does that sound about right?
I don't think 20% is 22. Yeah, I'm not going to quibble over 2%.
Yeah.
But yeah, close enough for government work.
Yeah, and you know, if I want to teach music for a living, one of the things that is really important to me is that I have students who can afford me, which means that they have to be working. So, you know, I'm looking at that part of the equation. Now, whenever a Republican talks about job creation, you know, I'm listening to BS.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Especially when it's coupled with, you know, eliminate taxes. Now, what's really going to happen is more of what we've had, which means, yeah, of course, the moneyed class are going to create jobs. They're going to create jobs in China.
Sure.
Which is
if they create any at all. But they didn't become the moneyed class by putting money out there. They became the moneyed class by not putting money out there, by socking it away, by hanging on to it like grim death, Richard.
Well, but they'll invest, you know, they'll invest in companies which are offshoring jobs. I mean, that's how you make tons of money, if you're making stuff. So I can go to my library has a take me box. People put magazines and stuff in there, and I take magazines. And it says there's some fairly enlightened stuff in that box. So a few times I've taken Politico. So we're talking here about the print version of Politico rather than the online version of Politico.
Right.
And there's advertisements in there. Who's advertising in Politico? Who do you think is advertising in Politico?
The money boys.
Well, it's the munitions people. It's what we call the defense industry.
Oh, dear God.
You know.
The death industry.
Yeah. These are the people of Grumman, you know, when you show all these happy people with hard hats on and stuff like that. And, see, I think that this is the industry that we have left in the U.S. This is the blue-collar stuff. It's you know, it's the military-industrial complex here. Because everything else is somewhere else. And I don't know. It's like, how do you create jobs in blue-collar jobs in fields that don't exist anymore?
In industries that are gone.
Exactly. I used to hear Republican, you know, lawmakers, congressmen or senators, you know, talking about, we don't make VCRs in this country anymore. Well, the truth is that we never made any VCRs in this country, ever.
No. No. I mean, you know, Sony, that's not a little company that was started by Hiram J. Sony in the garage behind his Ohio middle class home.
Right.
No.
And furthermore, none of this Japanese stuff is coming from Japan.
Mm-mm.
Look at the box, you know.
China.
You know. So even you know, the labor is too expensive for Japan. The Japanese companies are manufacturing in Malaysia, I don't know where else, you know, all over that part of the world. And China. Oh, yeah.
Wherever people are poor and desperate.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know when I mentioned it, maybe it was far enough back that you caught it on the podcast, but I can't look at an iPad anymore without thinking of a small army of human beings standing on their feet 12 hours a day, forbidden to speak to one another, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, forbidden to speak while working, putting together iPads, and the suicide rate has gotten so bad at the factory that Foxconn, the parent corporation, I love this capitalist logic, Richard. Rather than trying to address the horrific working conditions that are driving people to suicide, instead, I'm sure that some American consultant said, you know what you boys need to do? You need to put up nets. And so they did. They put up nets around the building so that when the disaffected workers become so sick of it all, they can no longer stand it, and they decide to leap to their deaths, they'll get caught in the net and just get rounded up and taken back to their little dormitory so they can be back on the assembly line next morning. Resistance is futile.
That's terrible. I don't know. You see, what I'm thinking is that we need very inefficient employment. We got to get people back to work and somehow. And the problem is, one of the problems I see is that we have worshipped at the altar of efficiency.
Yes, and let me back up with you then for a minute, Richard. I don't know that I'm exactly in line with you in saying we need inefficient labor. We need to re-examine our fetishization of so-called efficiency, because efficiency in the 21st century merely means human beings working harder for less. That's what efficiency means. Work harder, work longer, make less doing it.
And, of course, you're never efficient enough.
No. I mean, you know, it's the obsession with efficiency in the 21st century is frankly Stalinesque. You remember how it worked in the Soviet Union with the 5-year plans? Well, if you met your quota in year one, it meant that the quota was too low, so the quota has to be raised to the point where you can't make the quota. And once you can't make the quota, you're deemed inefficient and you go off to the gulag.
Yeah.
Well, that's not just a hell of a lot different from the American or global industrial theory that obtains today. If you're not being pressed to the absolute limits of your human endurance, something is wrong, because if you've got one iota of endurance left, that means that you're stealing from the company. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I sure do. Well, I see, I've done some projects for the telephone company, and I see their managers just like working themselves into their graves because they use something called management by objectives. I can't understand it, but basically they're given more and more and more responsibility, and they don't know what's going on. They're responsible for so much, they have no idea what's happening.
And yet, if you escalate up the food chain inside a corporate structure like that, eventually you get up to the CEO.
Right.
And the CEO's got one of those little perpetual motion devices, you know, with the five balls where if you swing one on one end, the three
yeah,
don't move,
okay,
and the other one on the other end
yeah,
moves.
Yeah, yeah.
And he does that all day. He doesn't work. He neither tarries nor does he sow. The CEO class at the very top, they sit around, and I'm sure that, some right-winger, were they allowed to listen to this program, Bob, you don't know. They work hard, them CEOs. Them some hard-working people. No, the whole point of becoming a CEO is to not work hard, because then you are a member of the wealthy, moneyed leisure class. And you know, it gets back to that conversation we had, I guess maybe a week ago. What is there on planet Earth that one person can do that is worth $50 million a year?
He faces the stockholders and not anybody else.
Yeah, bullshit. I'm talking about Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, Rush Limbaugh. Well, he's a
problem. All he does is sell ads hustling vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls and drop them on the Swedish mattress where you're laying there growing hair on the top of your balding head with an herbal erection remedy while contemplating buying gold.
Let me turn back to this efficiency worship. Our government does it. I've been looking at transit systems. You know, there's a system in Vancouver, British Columbia. A light rail operation. It's quite extensive. Well, there's nobody running the trains. It's all done by a computer. At least here, we have BART, you know, Bay Area Rapid Transit. The trains are run by a computer, but there's somebody sitting there who makes sure nobody gets stuck in the doors.
Yeah, is that the way it is with, like, the conductors or the engineers on, the metro in D.C.? Because, I mean, you see them there at the front of the train. They're there.
I don't know if the D.C. system is automated or not. The one here is. It was from the get-go. See, that's how they had to sell it to the taxpayers, to the voters. You know, that this thing is going to be so efficient, it's going to pay for itself because nobody's running the trains. And in England, they have, like London has this light rail system called the Docklands Light Railway. It's automated. It's completely automated. There's nobody. So if somebody falls on the track, the train will probably just roll over.
Yeah, too bad. You shouldn't have been near the tracks.
Exactly. Yeah. But you see, what I'm getting at is that, no, we don't need this automation. We need somebody on that train. You know, we need somebody in the middle of the train, you know, like a conductor. We need wastefulness, I think. I can't see that efficiency.
Well, right. I mean, and again, I come back to this semantic argument. We need to redefine it, Richard, because I don't believe it's wasteful for a human being to have time to contemplate the quality and quantity of life. You know, I like, yep. Yep. You know, I remember again, the one time I, left the country as a young man, being astonished because, you know, we were in Italy and, you know, everything shut down for a couple of hours in the afternoon because the shopkeeper went home and had lunch, caught a little nap, and then came back and did the rest of the day's business.
Yeah. Yeah. What country?
I mean, that was Italy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the concept of siesta is not just a Spanish phenomenon.
Sure, sure, sure.
And it, you know, there are certain people in corporate culture that, you know, drives them crazy. This kind of ties in with what Sandra and I were talking about with, you know, with Greece. Among other things, the Greek people have been maligned through this by the moneyed classes saying, well, you know, it's because they're lazy. You know, they don't really want to work. And the writer of this article said in one instance, said, I read, agog, an article in a well-known publication which essentially advocated that the mafia knew how to deal properly with people who didn't repay their debts, that, quote, this is a quote from the article, a baseball bat may be what's needed to fix the never-ending Greek debt mess.
God, I don't know.
Yeah, because that's the problem. They're just not working hard enough. You know, because the moneyed elite is so amoral, Richard, that it never dawns on them that maybe they're stealing too much.
Well, maybe, you know, let's talk about framing. You know, I'll suggest something that's bold, maybe. Maybe it's too bold. See, let me define what is America, you know, what is the United States, and I'm going to answer that. And say, the United States is its people. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if we start from that premise, somebody who exports jobs to another country is somewhat of a traitor. That's treasonous.
Yes.
Okay. That's my frame. And
well, that's why I said last Friday, that, you know, maybe we need to stop arguing with these freaks on the other side for a while and give them their wish. You know, let's tell the rich they don't have to pay taxes anymore. Let's tell the corporations they don't have to pay taxes anymore. My God, they're not paying them anyway, and we're not doing anything to them. You know, GE paid no taxes. Who else? You know, Citigroup, Citibank, whatever, no taxes. So, you know, even if we tell them what they have to pay them, they're so powerful they can not pay them and tell us to pound sand. Let's give these people their heads and tell them that they don't have to pay taxes anymore. But there's something that goes with that, Richard. Let's also tell them that they're no longer Americans, that they no longer have the civil rights that are provided to them and guaranteed to them under the Constitution of the United States. Because if you don't want to be a taxpayer, that by definition means you don't want to be my and Richard's fellow citizen. Because the rest of us are doing it.
Yeah. What do you think would happen?
Oh, there'd be a hue and cry. Well, see, that's just how it is with you communists.
You know,
but beat them up with it. Beat the piss out of them with it. It's like the approach that, you know, we've got this Indian coal company over here blowing a series of mountains up in my home county and sending it home to Mumbai one train car load at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how in the hell is that American? What debt? I mean, for all that I hold, for all the regard and reverence that I hold for Indian culture and history,
they're not it.
They're not it. And what, you know, what debt do I, Bob Kincaid of Fayette County, West Virginia, what debt do I owe to some sorry pair of son of a bitch brothers from Mumbai who've decided that they're not rich enough yet?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I saw those two jackasses from Mumbai, I'd spit in their faces.
Absolutely.
And feel like that it is my right to do so as an American.
And like another pair of brothers I'm thinking about.
Well, that's what they are. Shashi and Ravi Ruia are the Koch brothers of India.
Exactly, exactly.
And I and nobody in this state owes a pair of Indian capitalist bastards a goddamn thing. Pardon my mouth, Richard, but it, really.
No, really, I'm with you. I'll tell you, I'm just going to jump again. I have a couple of friends who I have told about you and, you know, and the Head On Network, and I have told them about Malloy. Now, Malloy can be accessed here. You know, Malloy.
Yeah, because he's on terrestrial radio there.
Yeah, he's on Clear Channel. He's on Clear Channel.
Green 960? Yeah, is that a Clear Channel station? Why am I?
Yeah, it is a Clear Channel station. You see, what happened is that Clear Channel gobbled up too much spectrum around here. They have more radio stations than they know what to do with. I don't know how many they have in San Francisco, but they've got at least 7 in San Jose alone. And San Jose and San Francisco are sort of an overlapping radio market. So,
sure.
You know, they decided to turn Green 960 over to the left wing because they weren't able to make enough money. They just spread out too thin. They owe too much. I can't stand listening to commercial radio. My head doesn't work that way. One day I turned it on and they had sucked the middle out of the show. They gave the middle hour to somebody else.
Oh, Jesus.
So, you know.
Program directors, ouch.
Yeah, so anyway, Malloy, I told these two people about Malloy, and I said, you really should listen to this guy, he's fantastic. And both of them said, I can't listen to him, he yells.
I
think you said, pardon my language. No, it's wonderful listening, you know, Malloy yells for all of us.
Yes, he yelled, you know, he's harsh and abrasive. Just look at him and say, you know, have you ever watched, you know, come on, catharsis, come on, it's an ancient topic of human nature. There's a reason you can't, there are stories where you just can't remain, sane and sober sides and like the Ladies Sewing Society. Are we supposed to maintain our decorum? When the house is burning down? No, you start screaming, get out, the house is burning.
Exactly, but you know what I think is happening is that these people have never heard anything like this before, you know? It's just like the first time I heard you, I was shocked by your yelling. And because I had never heard anybody do that before. I'm great with it now, and also your levels are more consistent than they used to be.
We've worked hard.
I bet. I'll bet.
And working, and there are more there are technical changes coming that would just make your head spin.
I believe it. But I'm saying, you know, I had to do a sudden mental adjustment. And look, I grew up listening to Gene Shepherd, man. I mean, I'm used to...
oh, I love Gene Shepherd. I was kindly provided a wallet of Gene Shepherd CDs, and they're just, I listen to them when I'm out driving around and stuff. Wow, they're wonderful.
Are they? He was a true radio artist, and I thought that, I mean, it is mind-boggling how he would tell those stories every night, a different story. He hardly ever repeated himself. And that he would wind up his show exactly on the second. You know?
Yeah. You said radio artist, and it is an art, and I will go so far as to say that for the biggest part, Richard, it is a gone, not a lost, but a gone art. Because stuff like that could not survive inside the monetized, commercialized, marketized.
Absolutely.
Because it's inimical to it.
I just had an opportunity to go back into radio, and you know it's been a lot of years since I did it, and I went through all this turmoil about it internally, and I realized, I don't think I want to do this. I don't think I want to do this to myself. because I would have to compromise my internal ideals so much to do it that I could, you know, how do you live with yourself?
Right.
You know, and I'm talking about classical music right now.
Wow.
Which is, as you have said, you know, about one of the reasons you don't like operas, because of the stylized nature of it. I'm going to say kabuki right now.
Yeah.
You know, and the problem with classical music in this country is that it's, you know, there are stylizations that are so entrenched with it that they destroy the wonder and beauty of the, you know, of this music. But that's a whole other topic. But I had to, you know, I had to say with myself, my God, you know, they're going to want me to program Rossini overtures, Rossini opera overtures. And it's like...
And is that something that just sends you screaming into the night, Richard?
Yes, of course. Rossini didn't even like them. They had to get him drunk. They had to lock him up and get him drunk for him to write the overture. They were all ready to put on the opera, and he hadn't written the overture yet.
Get me a cymbal and a harmonica. You know, I got your overture.
Well, I don't know. I was just listening to a wonderful pianist, a guy born in Texas, no less, who I have never heard of before. It's like if you want to hear really good classical musicians, look for people who don't have any reputation. You know,
nothing to lose.
That's,
nothing to lose.
Well, that's how I learned. You know, the big names are all sellouts. It's but this guy's name is Ivan Davis, and he was born in Texas. And boy, does he play great Chopin.
You know, I based on that recommendation, I'm going to go find some and just listen, because I am not well versed in classical music. It's one of those I know what I like, and I know, you know, and I know what sounds like spoons bouncing on pavement. No, Chopin is one of those that, yeah, all day long, love it.
Well, it's I mean, the problem with a lot of classical music is that it doesn't rock, and that is a problem. You know,
well, maybe in modern culture, but for me, you know, there's and I'll say the same thing. You know, there's jazz that I can't approach.
Yep.
You know, things that sound like a duck being tortured is not gonna, you know, as our buddy David in Tennessee has noted, you know, you can be in a room and it sounds like somebody's killing a duck, and you look around at the rest of the room and they're sitting there just, you know, head tilted to one side, eyes glazed over, you know, with this enrapt look on their faces, and you're going, bring me another beer. I don't get it. You know, I'm going over to the honky tonk where somebody's playing a Telecaster and I can understand.
Yeah. Well,
I've got examples of it in my music library here. And, I love Pat Metheny. But one of his heroes is Ornette Coleman. And I'm probably going to get hate mail over this. I can't listen to Ornette Coleman.
Well, I couldn't either when I first heard him. You know, Leonard Bernstein heard Ornette Coleman, and he went and dragged the whole New York Philharmonic Orchestra over to hear Ornette Coleman play.
All right, rub it in. I'm a complete Philistine now. Thank you, Richard.
No, I'm not going to say that. I bought his first album, you know, and on that he's playing a plastic alto saxophone. And I listened to it, and it was really difficult. See, for me, what I find...
Well, to me, when you're playing a plastic alto saxophone, that's just one step removed from Jethro Bodine playing the fiddle with the crank on it that you turn that plays Pop Goes the Weasel, damn it. You know, I mean, it just... It is. Golly Moses, I can't approach it. I don't have an extensive collection of local yodeling, because I just can't.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the thing I'm thinking about, there's some music that I can't handle. It's like I was once in a group with a guy who played shakuhachi. That's that Japanese flute, and it, you know, the music for it tends to use a scale that I just can't stand. And he was playing in a BART station in San Francisco, and people would come up to him and ask him to stop playing. Yeah. I mean...
Oh, that's the great old Marx Brothers routine with Groucho and Chico. Yeah, and what? And if we rehearse 3 days, that's $15. And Groucho says, "What do you get if you don't rehearse?" Ah, you can't afford that.
Well, you know, there's certain musical forms that I just have never been able to get behind. They just irritate me too much. Some Arabic scale forms really are just impossible for me to enjoy.
See, you are so far up the ladder from me. All I can do is say it sounds like somebody spilled the silverware on the cement floor.
What I'm saying is that I have the same problem. It's just at a different point.
You know, you're old enough to appreciate it. You remember the old Addams Family series with?
I never watched it though.
Oh, what a pity, John Astin and. I forget who played Morticia, but there would be these moments when Gomez would walk into the room and she would be sitting there with that Japanese banjo.
Oh.
And it would be entirely discordant, and it was a running gag because she'd just strum one strum and nothing, you know, everything was completely out of tune, one strum, and she'd scream, "Karoo!" And... Well, obviously, I'm such a little child of pop culture, and you know that's an inside joke inside the family because you know Fergal hit a sour note on his keyboard or on his guitar, and I'll just scream "Karoo!"
Well, I was I once had a record of Israeli music, you know, very heavily Arab influenced, and I couldn't stand it, and I said to myself, well, somebody likes this. Wait, but what's the difference between me and them? Well, the difference was that they were familiar with it, and I wasn't.
They grew up immersed in it.
Exactly. So
That's the same way that I can actually listen to forms of gospel music and not run screaming from the room when you'd be sharpening razor blades.
I don't get it.
I thought I recalled a conversation with you where you said, you know, I just can't take that gospel, that Southern gospel kind of.
Oh no, I love Southern gospel.
Oh, there was something that you absolutely hated, but that.
I have a hard time with some bluegrass.
Oh yeah, it was bluegrass. Yeah. See, I love bluegrass and.
No, yeah. I like the music. I just feel it's emotionally out of touch with itself. But that's a whole other.
Wow, that is another, you know, we could go for hours on these. Unfortunately, I got to get out of here because we're out of time, Richard, but it's been a wonderful conversation.
Hope I didn't cheat anybody who was blinking.
You're fine. You know, the blinking lights, everybody gets a chance. You know, it's not like the show's going off the air or anything.
Okay, listen, I want to wish everybody a happy weekend, and you too.
And a happy Independence Day. Absolutely. Thank you, Richard.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Richard calling from the Bay Area. Karoo. Sorry, I'm sure that's out there on YouTube. I need to add that as one of the sound files. I love that. Let's see. Do I have it? No, I'm out of time. Darn it. Let me just say thank you very much for a wonderful note, and I'll try to save it for when we get back on the 15th. I got this wonderful, wonderful note from Jessica. From Aaron. Aaron is 22 in New York and finishing up a bachelor's in history. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful note. And I appreciate it, and I hope to share it all with you later. Thank you, Aaron. So that's it. As far as I know, no live show. I don't know, maybe we'll get out early next Friday, too. But no live show until the 15th of July. So I hope you'll be there. But above all, please, please take advantage of this free educational discussion being brought your way on the horn from the PRISM West Virginia American History Academy. Please do. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Thank you first and foremost to you who contribute to the program. Thank you very much. Thank you to John Fox, our chief engineer, who's worked so tirelessly to make the PRISM stuff go. Thank you to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, who makes all the streaming stuff happen and has... My God, for 9 years, can you imagine? He needs your help when you can help as well. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thank you to our op-ed correspondent, Reverbo, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, a cavalcade of crazy. Thanks go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, Judy.